Two.
She turned and went into a storeroom and returned with a large cucumber. The sucker move, John knew, proved that the blade was sharp and real. She inserted the cucumber into the guillotine's wooden collar, clamped down a lock, stepped back, pulled up the chrome blade, and let it fall. The cucumber lay on the counter in two neat halves. "Good enough," said the carrot lady. She squinted up at John's father. "What we need now is an arm."
"Sorry?"
"Your arm," she said. His father chuckled.
"No way on earth."
"Off with the jacket." His father tried to smile. A tall, solid-looking man, curly black hair and blue eyes, and an athlete's sloping shoulders. It took him a long while to peel off his jacket.
"Guillotine of death," he muttered. "Very unusual."
"Slip your wrist in there. No sudden movements."
"Christ," he said.
"That's the spirit," she said. The carrot lady's eyes were merry as she hoisted up the blade. She held it there for a few seconds, then motioned for John to step behind the counter. "You know this trick?" she said. His father's eyes swept sideways.
"Hell no, he doesn't know it."
"I do," John said. "It's easy."
"The kid doesn't have the slightest..."
"Simple," John said. His father frowned, curled up his fingers, and frowned again. His forearm looked huge and meaty in the guillotine collar.
"Listen, what about instructions?" he said. "These things come with instructions, right? Seriously, written down instructions?"
"Oh, for Pete's sake," John said. "She told you to relax." He grasped the blade handle. Power. That was the thing about magic. The carrot lady folded her arms. The green stars on her cheeks seemed to twinkle with desire. "Go on," she said. "Let him have it."
There were times when John Wade wanted to open up Kathy's belly and crawl inside and stay there forever. He wanted to swim through her blood and climb up and down her spine and drink from her ovaries and press his gums against the firm red muscle of her heart. He wanted to suture their lives together. It was terror, mostly. He was afraid of losing her. He had his secrets. She had hers. So now and then he'd play spy tricks. On Saturday mornings he'd follow her over to the dry cleaners on Okabena Avenue, then to the drugstore and post office. Afterward he'd tail her across the street to the supermarket, watching from a distance as she pushed a cart up and down the aisles. Then he'd hustle back to the apartment and wait for her to walk in. "What's for lunch?" he'd ask. And Kathy would give him a quick look and say, "You tell me." Briefly then, as she put the groceries away, Kathy's eyes would darken up with little flecks of gray. Such eyes, he'd think. He'd want to suck them from their sockets. He'd want to feel their weight on his tongue, taste the whites, roll them around like lemon drops. Instead, he'd watch Kathy fold the grocery bags.
"You know, maybe I'm way off," she'd say, "but I get this creepy feeling, like you're always there, always worming around inside me."
John would smile his candidate smile.
"Very true. Not worming, though. Snaking."
"You didn't go out today?"
"Out where?"
"I don't know where. It just seemed..."
He'd pin her against the refrigerator tight. He'd run a hand along the bone of her hip. He'd whisper in her ear,
"Boy," he'd say, "do I love you. Boy, oh boy."
"So you didn't go out?"
"Let's be cobras, you and me. Gobble each other up."
Sorcerer was in his element. It was a place with secret trap doors and tunnels, and underground chambers populated by various spooks and goblins. A place where magic was everyone's hobby, and where elaborate props were always on hand. Exploding boxes and secret chemicals, and numerous devices of levitation. You could fly here. You could make other people fly. A place where the air itself was both reality and illusion. Where anything might instantly become anything else. It was a place where decency mixed intimately with savagery.
where you could wave your wand and make teeth into toothpaste, civilization into garbage, where you could intone a few syllables over a radio and then sit back to enjoy the spectacle, pure mystery, pure miracle, a place where every object and every thought and every hour seemed to glow with all the unspeakable secrets of human history. The jungles stood dark and unyielding. The corpses gaped. The war itself was a mystery. Nobody knew what it was about, or why they were there, or who started it, or who was winning, or how it might end. Secrets were everywhere. Booby traps in the hedgerows, bouncing Bettys under the red clay soil. And the people, the silent papasans, the hollow-eyed children and jabbering old women. What did these people want? What did they feel? Who was VC and who was friendly? And who among them didn't care? These were all secrets. History was a secret. The land was a secret. There were secret caches, secret trails, secret codes, secret missions, secret terrors and appetites and longings and regrets. Secrecy was paramount. Secrecy was the war. A guy might do something very brave, charge a bunker maybe, or stand up tall under fire, and afterward everyone would look away and stay quiet for a while. Then somebody would say, "How the fuck do you do that?" And the brave guy would blink and shake his head because he didn't know, because it was one of those incredible secrets inside him. Sorcerer had his own secrets. PFC Weatherby, that was one. Another was how much he loved the place. Vietnam, how it felt like home. And there was the deepest secret of all, which was the secret of Tuan Yen. So secret that he sometimes kept it secret from himself. John Wade knew he was sick, and one evening he tried to talk about it with Kathy. He wanted to unload the horror in his stomach. "It's hard to explain," he said, "but I don't feel real sometimes, like I'm not here." They were in the apartment making dinner, and the place smelled of onions and frying hamburger. "You're real to me," Kathy said. "Very real and very good." "I hope so, except I'm afraid to look at myself. Literally, I can't even look at my own eyes in the mirror, not for long. I'm afraid I won't be there." Kathy glanced up from the onion she was chopping. "Well, I adore looking at you," she said. "It's my second favorite thing to do." "Good. I still wonder..." John put the hamburgers on a platter. Kathy dumped on the onions. She seemed nervous, as if she were aware of certain truths, but could not bear to know what she knew, which was in the nature of their love. "If you want," she said, "we'll skip supper. Do my favorite thing." "I'm serious." "So am I." "Kath, listen. I need to tell you this. Something's wrong. I've done things..." "It doesn't matter." "It does." She smiled brightly at a spot over his shoulder. "We could catch a movie." "Ugly things. A good movie wouldn't hurt." "Christ, you're not..." She picked up the hamburger platter. "We'll be fine. Totally fine." "Sure," he said. "Wait and see." "Sure." They were quiet for a moment. He looked at her. She looked at him. Anything could have happened. Sorcerer didn't say a word about PFC Weatherby. It was reflex, after all. But for many days he felt a curious discomfort, almost giddy at times, almost sad at other times. On guard at night, watching the dark, Sorcerer would see PFC Weatherby start to smile, then topple backward, then make a funny jerking motion with his hand. Like a hitchhiker, Sorcerer thought. A poor bum who couldn't catch a ride. On the afternoon his father was buried, John Wade went down to the basement and practiced magic in front of his stand-up mirror. He did feints and sleights. He talked to his father. "I wasn't fat," he said. "I was normal." He transformed a handful of copper pennies into 4 white mice. And I didn't jiggle, not even once. I just didn't. It was in the nature of their love that Kathy did not insist that he see a psychiatrist, and that John did not feel the need to seek help. By and large, he was able to avoid the sickness down below. He moved with determination across the surface of his life, attending to a marriage and a career. He performed the necessary tricks, dreamed the necessary dreams. On occasion, though, he'd yell in his sleep, loud, desperate, obscene things, and Kathy would reach out and ask what was wrong. Her eyes would betray visible fear. "It wasn't even your voice," she'd say. "It wasn't even you." John would force a laugh. He would have no memory beyond darkness. "Bad dreams," he'd tell her, which he believed to be true, but which did not sound true, even to himself. He would hold her in his arms. He would lie there quietly, eyes wide open, taking from her skin what he needed. And then later, sometimes for hours, Sorcerer would watch his wife sleep. Sometimes he'd say things. "Kath," he'd say, peering down at her. "Kath, my Kath." The palm of his hand poised above her lips, as if to control the miracle of her breathing. In the dark, sometimes he would see a vanishing village. He would see PFC Weatherby and his father's white casket, and a little boy trying to manipulate the world. Other times he would see himself performing the ultimate vanishing act, a grand finale, a curtain closer. He did not know the technique yet, or the hidden mechanism, but in his mind's eye he could see a man and a woman swallowing each other up, like that pair of snakes along the trail near Pinkville, first the tails, then the heads, both of them finally disappearing forever inside each other. Not a footprint, not a single clue, purely gone. The trick of his life. The burdens of secrecy would be lifted, memory would be null. They would live in perfect knowledge, all things visible, all things invisible. No wires or strings, just that large, dark world where 1 plus 1 will always come to 0. And so he'd lie watching her for much of the night. "Kath, sweet Kath," he'd murmur, as if summoning her spirit, feeling the rise and fall of her breath against his hand. Chapter 11. What He Did Next. John Wade slept late the next morning, a jumpy, electric sleep. It was almost noon by the time he'd showered and moved out to the kitchen. Still groggy, he brewed up a pot of coffee, scrambled 3 eggs, and carried his breakfast out to the porch. Another brilliant day. Ivory clouds pinned to a glossy blue sky. He sat on the steps and ate his eggs. Little dream filaments kept unwinding in his head, hissing noises, a flapping sound. At one point he glanced behind him, startled. "Hey, Kath," he said. He listened. Then he yelled, "Kath!" Then he waited and yelled, "Kath! Come here a minute!" Inside, he rinsed the dishes and poured himself another cup of coffee. A half hour, he thought, and she'd show up. A nature hike or something. Most mornings, she liked to head up along the shoreline or follow one of the trails out toward the fire tower. Another half hour, an hour tops. Right now, he decided it was time for some major house cleaning. An unpleasant odor filled the air, a vegetable stink, and for starters, he would do away with last night's debris. Tidy up the cottage, then go to work on his life. Wade compressed the idea into a firm resolution. Get up early from now on. Jog a few miles before breakfast. Whittle off the campaign flab. Then sort through the larger mess. See if he could figure out a future for himself. Later in the day, he'd sit down with Kathy and try to hammer out a few decisions. The first priority was their checkbook, a job of some sort. Make a few phone calls and see what pity could buy. Shape up, he thought. Start now. Moving briskly, Wade dug out a plastic garbage bag, marched into the living room, and collected the dead house plants. He carried the bag outside and dumped it in one of the trash cans at the rear of the cottage. No doubt Kathy had discovered the wreckage that morning, or at least smelled it, and at some point soon he would have to come up with a fancy piece of defense work. Extenuating circumstances, he'd say. Which was the truth. A miserable night, nothing else. So he'd apologize, and then prove to her that he was back in control. A solid citizen, upright and virtuous. The thought gave him energy. He did a load of laundry, ran a mop across the kitchen floor. Already he felt better. A matter of willpower. For more than an hour, he made his way through a stack of correspondence, setting aside a few items and junking the rest. Tidiness was paramount. He went through the bank statements, knocked off 20 sit-ups, put in another load of laundry, spent a few minutes wandering without aim from room to room. The place seemed curiously vacant. In the bedroom, Kathy's slippers were aligned at the foot of the bed. Her blue robe hung from its hook near the door. There was a faint scent of ammonia in the air. Quietly, afraid to disturb things, he moved down the hallway to the bathroom, where Kathy's toothbrush stood bristles up in an old jelly jar. The water faucet was dripping. He turned it off. He listened for a moment, then returned to the kitchen. It was a little after 1:30. The fringes of the afternoon had already crossed into shadow. Wade fixed himself a vodka tonic and carried it over to the kitchen window. Vaguely, without alarm, he wondered what was keeping her. Maybe payback. The plant thing would have turned her upside down, especially in light of other revelations, and no doubt she was now sending a message. Domestic screws, the contemplation of error and misdeed. The thing to do, he reasoned, was maintain his resolve. Start by compiling a few lists. A self-improvement list, then a list of assets and debits, then a list of law firms in need of cheap labor. He poured another drink and sat down with a pencil and paper, letting the ideas come, cheerfully assembling a detailed list of all the fine lists he would make. The booze was performing acrobatics on his nerves. Nothing to it. Go with the lists. At 4 o'clock, he folded the laundry and did some random dusting. The afternoon had cooled fast. Restless, woozy at the margins, he freshened his drink and carried it out to the sofa in the living room. There was still that ammonia after-scent in the air, an operating room smell, and for a second he felt an illicit little tug at his memory. Something about the events of last night, antiseptics and jungle smells. He took a breath and lay back. Gradually, a nice calm came over him, the chemical somersaults, and for a considerable time he permitted himself the luxury of forgetfulness. No lists, no future at all, just the glide, exploring the void. And then later, half dozing, John Wade detected movement in the room. Like a breeze, it seemed, as if a window had been left open. Emotion so delicate he would both remember it and not remember it. A mind trick for sure, but he could not ignore the pressure of Kathy's fingertips against the lids of his eyes. The surface tension was real. He heard her footsteps. He heard the low voice that could be only Kathy's voice. "So stupid," she said. "You could have tried me." And then came a fearful silence as she moved away, a drop in the temperature, a subtle relaxation in the magnetic force that one human body exerts upon another. At 6 o'clock, John Wade put on a jacket, fortified himself with a quick drink, and walked down to the dock. The evening had turned winter cold. A wind was up, which put whitecaps on the lake, and the timber to the west had darkened to a dirty shade of gold. What was necessary, Wade concluded, was the strictest allegiance to common sense. No cause for worry. Plenty of possibilities. He looked south toward the fire tower, then out at the whitecaps, then up at a sky painted in silky, backlit blues. Already the first stars were out. In a half hour, the darkness would be solid. He stood still for a time, studying the shadows, trying to figure things.
"Okay," he said. Something wobbled in his stomach. It wasn't right. He knew that.
Turning, he hustled back to the cottage, found a flashlight, and started up the dirt road toward the fire tower. He felt slippery inside, the vodka float. Multiple calamities had come to mind. A bad fall, lacerations, broken bones. Kathy was smart, yes, but she knew nothing about this wilderness. A suburb slicker. That was the joke between them. How she adored nature, but didn't see why it had to be outside. Opposites were built into her personality. Contradiction was the rule. She enjoyed her morning stroll, the solitude and fresh air, but even then she conceived of nature as a department store, with potted trees and a gigantic glass roof, which could turn unfortunate. He moved fast, at times trotting, conscious of the approaching dark. After 10 minutes, the road curved west and dipped down into a shallow ravine. Off to the left, a narrow footpath led into the woods toward the fire tower. Wade paused there, switched on the flashlight, scanned the cattails and deep brush. He edged forward a few steps, using the flashlight as a probe. Tempting, he thought. Plunge in and head for the fire tower. Except he was no trailblazer. The path wound off into soiled twilight purples, lavish and darkly tangled, vanishing altogether after a few yards. Everything blended with everything else, trees and brush and sky, and already he was on the edge of lost. He stepped back onto the road and turned off his flashlight. There was a familiar breathing sound, something both distant and nearby. "Kath," he said. He listened hard, shook his head. Right now, he reasoned, she'd be back at the cottage. Not probably, for sure. The notion calmed him. To be safe, he hiked another quarter mile up the road, occasionally swinging the flashlight's yellow beam into the woods on both sides. At the old iron bridge over Tyne Creek, he stopped and called out her name a couple of times, softly at first, then louder, but there was only the near-far breathing in the dark. "Yo-yo," he told himself. He turned back up the road. It was a little past 7 when he reached the cottage. He checked inside again, knowing she wasn't there, then transported a fresh drink out to the porch. The night was dull and ordinary. Waves foaming up against the dock. A few tired loons. It was as if she'd gone next door to borrow something from a neighbor, except there weren't any neighbors. A mile to the nearest occupied cottage, another 8 miles to the nearest paved road. He looked down at the boathouse, then at the sky, then back to the boathouse. It occurred to him that he might call someone, Claude Rasmussen maybe, but the idea seemed excessive. Any time now she'd come skipping up the road. Absolutely. It had to happen like that. At 9 o'clock he took a hot shower. At 10:30 he finished off the vodka and switched to rum. Just after midnight, a swell of nausea rose up into his throat, which turned to terror, and for the first time it came to him what must have happened. He found the flashlight again and made his way down to the boathouse. "Not drunk," he told himself. Unsteady, yes, but he could see things clearly. For more than an hour he'd been watching the image compose itself, a slow sharpening, the boathouse gradually taking shape. The tar paper walls and sagging roof and stone foundation. The big double doors facing the lake. There was no hurry. He knew exactly what he would find. The night fog had settled in, which gave the earth a slick, mossy feel, and Wade found it necessary to assess each step for the possibility of hazard. He counted the reasons not to be afraid. She could handle herself. A good, strong swimmer. And he loved her. That was the best reason. So much love. Therefore, nothing more could happen to them. He nodded at this. Ahead, the flashlight punched pale holes in the night. A gusty wind pressed in off the lake, and in the darkness there were numerous snappings and collisions. Oddly, he felt the desire to weep, but not the need. Outside the boathouse, Wade paused to collect himself. The double doors stood partly open. The right panel dangled from its upper hinge, swaying slightly, its rusted hinge producing a soft, musical squeak. It wasn't fear now. It was certainty. He pulled the doors back, stepped inside, swung the flashlight across the dirt floor. There was no surprise. The boat was gone, as it had to be. The outboard was gone, too, and the gas can, and the orange life vest, and the two fiberglass oars. Wade considered the facts. They had been married 16 years, almost 17, and there was now the powerful certainty that the dominant track of his life had been permanently rerouted. He stepped outside, closed the boathouse doors. "So," he said, which sounded conclusive. Briefly, he allowed Kathy's presence to make itself known. The trim, well-cared-for body, the champagne wrinkles at her eyes, the little girl hands and summer skin and polished white smile. She knew things. No more secrets. She'd seen the headlines. She understood his capabilities. In the dark, she seemed to smile at him. Then she jerked sideways. Puffs of steam rose from the sockets of her eyes. Impossible, of course. He turned away, dug out his keys, and hurried up the slope to the Buick.
"I'm not drunk," Wade said.
"Who said drunk?"
"I'm not."
Ruth Rasmussen laid out a vinyl tablecloth, smoothed the edges, and brought over a mug of coffee.
"Big swallow," she said. "It'll seal up the leaks." "I'm sober."
"Sure you are. Down the happy hatch." Ruth touched his shoulder and turned back to the stove. She was a large, sturdy woman in her mid-50s, tall and rugged-looking, with a graceful way of carrying the extra 30 pounds at her hips and belly. A spray of silvery black hair fell well below her shoulders.
"So just relax," she was saying. "Your wife's fine. One of those things..."
"The boat, though. The boat's gone."
Ruth made an exasperated clucking sound.
"Right. I believe you mentioned the fact a couple 30, 40 times now. That's what boats are mostly for. They go places."
She dropped a log into her wood cookstove, adjusted the flue valve, clanged down the iron cover.
"Some dumb screw-up. The Evinrude clunked out on her for sure, that's what happened. Plugs or something. Cord got busted."
She turned and looked down at his coffee mug.
"Sugar?"
Wade shook his head.
"It's not right. She wouldn't. It feels bad."
"Wait and see. Claude'll drive you back. Check things out. Come on now, drain it."
The coffee was lukewarm and bitter, worse than bad. But Wade drank it down and started on another cup. After a minute, Ruth put a loaf of bread in front of him.
"This much for sure," she said. "It don't help one bit to be negative. I bet it's that cruddy old outboard. Million times I told Claude to spring cash money for a new one. Billion times. Think he'd do it? No, sir. Not if it involves a wallet."
She chuckled at this and sat down across from him.
"Trick is to think positive. Think bad, get bad. Always works that way, seems to me."
Wade looked blankly at the table. His head hurt. His elbow joints, too, and other parts he couldn't locate.
"It still feels wrong. Gone all day. Almost all night."
"Well, so the lady got herself stranded. So what? People run out of gas, lose an engine, all kinds of nutty stuff. Happens more than you think. Besides, your wife strikes me real solid, like somebody who can take care of herself."
Ruth sprinkled brown sugar on a wedge of bread and slipped it across the table.
"Great big bite. It'll soak up the poisons. Then we'll see what we see."
"Ruth, I don't think... Eat!"
Behind him, at the rear of the house, there was the sound of a toilet flushing. Claude Rasmussen came out carrying a pair of work boots and a corduroy hunting jacket. The old man went to the sink, hacked up some phlegm, spat, and bent forward to examine the discharge. He turned and looked up at Ruth.
"So how's our good senator?"
"Like a judge," she said. "Sober almost." The old man grinned. He was pushing 80 and showed it, but his eyes were still sharp and clear. After a moment, he sat down and began lacing up his boots.
"Sober enough to navigate?"
"Just fine," Wade said.
"Sure you are. Finely lubricated, I'd say."
Claude grinned again.
"What we'll do is, we'll head down to the cottage, poke around a little. Ruth will make a few calls into town."
He shot a coded glance at his wife. "Try Vinnie Pearson, the mini-mart, whoever else you can shake out." Claude slid in a denture plate, bit down once, and pulled on a filthy Twins baseball cap.
"There's the program. Amendments, Senator?"
"Cute," Wade said.
"Well, yeah, I try."
Ruth slapped her big hands together.
"Go on now. Things will sort out."
Outside, Wade surrendered the keys and sat back as the old man swung the Buick into the fog. None of it seemed real, like riding through someone else's life, the car and the road and the oncoming darkness. Claude drove one-handed, braking hard at the curves, his quick, shrewd eyes scanning the road. The old man's health was failing, a bad heart and a half-century of Pall Malls, but he still had the sly intelligence that had long ago made him a wealthy man. Though he found it convenient to pretend otherwise, Claude was no hick caretaker. He owned the cottage and plenty more. 7 miles of shoreline, 12,000 acres of prime timber butting up against state forest. He had the road access rights, too, which were leased out to Weyerhaeuser, and a major share in the 2 big resorts on the lake. Originally from Duluth, he'd made his money hauling taconite, trucks at first, and then a small lake fleet, and for 10 years Wade had known him casually as one of the old-time party contributors. They were not friends in any meaningful sense. Barely acquaintances, really. But after the primary, the only phone call that mattered had come from Claude Rasmussen. He'd offered the cottage and clean air and 2 weeks without newspapers, which was enough. A tough bird, obviously, but right now, toughness was a comfort. At the cottage where the road widened out, Claude cut the engine and let the car roll down the slope to the boathouse. For a few moments they sat quietly in the dark, letting their eyes adjust. The old man pulled a flashlight from the glove compartment.
"How's the gyroscope? You can walk okay?"
"Perfect. I can walk great."
"Just a question."
Claude made an indifferent motion with his shoulders.
"Your breath, man. Devil rum, smells like. Even an old goat like me, I can tell rum from crapola."
He opened his door.
"Let's see this terrific walk of yours."
The fog had stacked up thick along the shore, moist and oily, and Wade felt an unpleasant weight in his lungs as he followed the old man over to the boathouse. Claude swung open the double doors and aimed his flashlight at the boat rack. Very pure, Wade thought. All that emptiness. After a time, Claude tipped his cap back, squatted down, ran a hand along the dirt floor.
"Yeah, well," he said, "we got a gone boat."
"I told you."
"Sure, you told me."
The old man stood up. He seemed to be listening for something.
"Took herself a little ride. Don't mean diddly. She's not back yet."
"No kidding."
"That's what I admire about you, Senator. Plenty of optimism."
They went outside, checked the dock, then moved up through the rocks to the cottage. Inside, Wade snapped on the kitchen lights. Immediately, he felt a new stiffness to the place, like a museum, everything frozen and hollow. He followed Claude from room to room, vaguely hopeful, but already a great stillness had entered the objects of their lives. Her blue bathrobe, her slippers at the foot of the bed, the book of crossword puzzles, folded open on the kitchen counter. That quick, Wade thought. In the living room, Claude stopped and surveyed things. He looked puzzled.
"The phone, man. Where's it at?"
"Around," Wade said. "I unplugged it."
"Unplugged?
What's the difference? We needed quiet. I put it away somewhere." The old man sucked out his upper denture. He seemed to be computing a run of numbers in his head.
"Well, sure. Quiet's fine. Except I don't see why you had to go and hide the damn thing."
"I didn't hide it. I told you, it's here."
"Unplugged, though?"
"Yes."
Claude's eyes roamed. "So in other words, there's no way your wife could have called, like if she got stuck in town, or got delayed or something?"
"I suppose not."
"You suppose?"
"Right. She couldn't." Wade turned away. It took a few minutes to locate the telephone under the kitchen sink. He felt the old man's eyes tracking him as he carried it out to the living room and plugged it in. Claude dialed, listened for a moment, and hung up.
"Busy," he said. "Ruth's probably got your lady on the horn right now."
"You think?"
"I think we cool our heels. Don't get all panicked up."
"I'm not panicked," Wade said. "I'm worried."
"Fair enough. You're worried."
The old man took off his cap and ran a hand across the top of his head, smoothing down hair that wasn't there.
"No harm in worry, but I'll tell you a true fact. This place here, I've run it 24 straight years. Haven't lost one single paying customer. The factual truth. Not even one, except for a few dumbass fishermen, which I'm pissed to say wasn't permanent."
Wade shook his head.
"Doesn't mean she's not in trouble."
"Right. It means we wait."
"Just sit?"
"Hell no, we don't just sit. Where's that knockout rum of yours?" They moved out to the kitchen. Wade fixed a pair of drinks, passed one over to Claude, and looked up at the clock over the stove. Almost 2 in the morning. She'd been gone 15 hours, maybe longer, and ugly pictures were beginning to form. Seaweed hair. A bottom-up boat. Claude's voice seemed to come from Canada.
"I say, can she swim?"
"Swim?
Your wife."
Wade blinked and nodded.
"Yes.
Good swimmer."
"Well, there you are then, hey?"
"But it seems like, I don't know, like we should get out there and start looking."
"Look where?"
"Anywhere. Just look." Claude was chewing on an ice cube. He squinted down at his drink, then sighed and swallowed.
"Maybe you didn't notice," he said. "But it's dead dark out there. Black as sin. That's item one. Plus, we got fog. Plus, a couple thousand square miles of water. Not to mention forest. Not to mention God knows how many islands and sandbars and crap. Can't accomplish a damn thing."
"The police, then."
"What police? Vinnie Pearson? He runs the Texaco station. Vinnie's the police. Gets $80 a month part-time. What's he gonna do?" "I'll tell you what. He's gonna say, 'Man, get your ass back to sleep,' which is pretty much what I say. Nothing we can do till morning, that's a fact. Worst it can be, your wife's beached up somewhere."
"No way," Wade said.
"You sound awful certain."
"A feeling. I know."
"You know?"
"That's right." Claude removed his cap again. He was silent for a while, studying a spot at the center of Wade's forehead.
"One thing I'm curious about. You two lovebirds didn't... It wasn't like a fight or something."
"No."
"A spat, I mean."
"Of course not."
The old man frowned. "No big deal. Like with Ruth and me, sometimes we get itchy in the temper. She'll say something, I'll say something. Pretty soon we're pitching hand grenades across the kitchen. It happens that way."
"Not with us," Wade said. "I woke up this morning, Kathy was gone."
That's it?
Everything.
Well, good. There we are. The old man leaned back in his chair. There was a question in his eyes, something that hadn't yet shaped itself. He gazed thoughtfully at a stack of empty flower pots on the kitchen counter.
No fight, no problem, he finally said. I was you, Senator. I just give it time. See what Ruth comes up with.
Let's dispense with the Senator's shit.
Wasn't meant to offend.
Just lay off. I'm no Senator.
Claude smiled.
Got thumped pretty bad. 3-1, I guess.
Close enough.
Damn pity. Democrats, they're a tough bunch to please. Like with me, I'm what you call a real true blue Minnesota DFLer. Hubert and Orville and Floyd B. Olson, that crew, the old kick-ass corn farmer boys. Meat and potatoes, so to speak. Say what you mean what you say. One thing I don't care for, it's pussyfoot politics.
There was silence while the old man refilled his glass.
Anyhow, he said, can't say I voted for you.
Wade shrugged.
Not many can.
Nothing personal.
No, it never is.
Claude gave him a sidelong glance, amused.
Other hand, I'm not saying I didn't. Maybe so, maybe not. What surprised me, the thing I don't get, you never once asked for help. Money-wise, I mean.
You could have asked.
And then what? Hard to say. People claim I'm a sucker for lost causes.
The old man hesitated.
Truth is, you didn't have a Chinaman's prayer. Not after all that nasty shit hit the papers. Even so, I might have tossed in a few bucks.
Well, good. The thought counts.
A hatchet job. Made you look... I guess it's not something you care to talk about?
I guess not. The old man nodded. He glanced at the clock and pushed himself up.
Sit tight. I'll try Ruth again.
Wade's head was pounding. That fuzzy, seasick feeling had settled back over him. He couldn't make the ugly pictures go away. The debris was bobbing up all around him, ghosts and algae and bits of bone. He listened as Claude dialed. The old man spoke quietly for a few minutes, then sighed and hung up.
No luck. Ruth'll keep at it. Plenty more names to call.
The police, Wade said.
Maybe.
Not maybe. Kathy's out there. We need to get something started. Right now.
The old man stuffed his hands in his back pockets, absently, frowning slightly. He looked at the stack of clay pots near the sink.
Well, see, I already explained. Vinny ain't no Kojak. All he can do is call down to the sheriff in Baudette, put out some boats, line up a plane or two.
That's a start, Wade said. It's something.
I guess.
So let's move.
Claude was still evaluating the empty pots. He waited a moment, then crossed over to the kitchen sink.
Those flowers, man. What the hell happened?
Nothing, Wade said.
An accident.
Yeah?
Claude, we're wasting time.
A little vein wobbled at the old man's forehead. He picked up one of the pots and turned it in his hands.
Some accident, he said.
Chapter 12. Evidence. It has been said that a miracle is the result of causes with which we are unacquainted. Once these causes are discovered, we no longer have a miracle, but natural law. In a way, all of us dislike the laws of nature. We should prefer to make things happen in the more direct way, in which savage people imagine them to happen, through our own invocation. Robert Parrish, The Magician's Handbook. He actually thought of himself as sorcerer. That's how it seemed to me. And Kathy was his main audience. I can't see how she put up with it. Maybe she hoped he'd pull off a real miracle or something. For her own life, I mean. I guess sometimes my sister thought of him as sorcerer, too.
Patricia S. Hood.
For the spectator, there is the complimentary pleasure of yielding passively to an omnipotent and mysterious force, of submitting helplessly to mounting swells of excitement where reason is overthrown and judgment scuttled. Bernard C. Meyer, Houdini, A Mind in Chains. He was a charmer, literally. Wrap you up in charms till you couldn't fucking move. Anthony L. Tony Carbo. A nice, polite man, if you ask me. Ruth Rasmussen. Kathy knew he had these secrets, things he wouldn't talk about. She knew about the spying. Maybe I'm wrong, but it was like she needed to be part of it. That whole sick act of his. Bethany Key, Associate Admissions Director, University of Minnesota. You may find yourself crying in corners and vowing that his buddies may have died on him in Vietnam. The brass may have turned its collective back on him, but you will never desert him. He needs you. Whether he can say it or not, whether he can act like it or not, he needs you. Patience H. C. Mason, recovering from the war. I guess Kathy loved him so much, she couldn't see what was happening all around her, like this pixie dust. Sprinkle on the love, you end up fooling yourself. Patricia S. Hood. Audiences want to believe what they see a magician do, and yet at the same time they know better and do not believe. Therein lies the fascination of magic to modern people. It is a paradox, a riddle, a half-fulfillment of an ancient desire, a puzzle, a torment, a cheat, and a truth. Robert Parrish, The Magician's Handbook. Exhibit 8. John Wade's Box of Tricks, Partial List. Chinese Rings, Loda Bowl, Sponge Balls, Stripper Deck, Magician's Wax, Postcard from Father, dated July 19, 1956, Photograph of Unidentified Granite Building, Handwriting Largely Illegible, Out of Here Soon, Can't Wait to, Dad, Magician's Milk, 2 Cans, Silk Load, Book, Time Telepathy, Book, Tarbell Course in Magic, Volume 1, Assorted Catalogs, Kara's Studio of Magic. That summer when John was 11, it got to where I didn't have any choice. The drinking just got worse and worse. His father would be down at the American Legion all afternoon and half the night. Finally, I got up the nerve to check him into the state treatment center up north. I hate to say it, but it was a relief to have him out of the house. John and I, we both adored the man, but suddenly all the tension was gone, and we could have supper without sitting there on the edge of our seats. A couple of times we drove up to visit John's dad on weekends. We'd go out on this grassy lawn and eat picnic lunches and, well, it was nice. I remember one time we were getting ready to leave. I remember his father walked us over to the car and put his arms around me and kissed me and almost cried and said he loved me and he was sorry and everything would be better now. It wasn't, though. It never got much better. Eleanor K. Wade. In every trick, there are two carefully thought-out lines, the way it looks and the way it is. The success of your work depends upon your understanding the relationship of these lines. Robert Parrish, The Magician's Handbook. I'm no psychiatrist, but if you ask me, politicians in general are pretty insecure people. Look at me, fat as a pig, love-starved. Laughter. So we go public. We're performers. We get up on stage and sing and dance and do our little show. Anything to please folks. Anything for applause. Like children. Just suck up the love. Anthony L. Tony Carbo. John used to come into the store a lot, 10, 11 years old. At first he seemed frightened, but after a while he started spending almost every Saturday there. A nice kid, I thought. I'd show him the new effects that came in. Effects, that's what we call tricks. And we'd practice them together. He always called me the Carrot Lady, even when he got older. I doubt if he even knew my real name. Sandra Cara, Cara's Studio of Magic. If you want to find help for your vet, Avoid churches that ascribe evil to outside forces, the devil tempting or taking over people. One reason for this is that maintaining an external locus of control, the devil made me do it, precludes adult responses, such as growing and profiting from experience. Patience H. C. Mason, recovering from the war. Millions of them. Big mean fuckers. These were some very pissed off flies. Richard Thinbill. The fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or of a superior does not relieve him from responsibility under international law. The Nuremberg Principles. Glossary. Load. A hidden packet or bundle of objects to be magically produced. Loadable. A piece of magical apparatus which appears to be empty or filled with liquid at the magician's whim. Misdirection. Any technique used by a magician to divert the audience's attention from noticing some secret maneuver. Dear Kath, this letter will be short because there's not much to say right now. All I can think about is hopping on that freedom bird and heading home and getting married and spending the next 10 years in bed. Horny, horny. Basically, things have been pretty tense lately. We keep taking casualties, mostly booby traps and stuff, but we can't ever find old Victor Charlie. It gets frustrating, and I guess everybody's kind of wound up. Hard to describe, like this weird infection or something. Sometimes you can almost smell it or taste it, like there's something wrong with the air. Anyhow, I've made it this far, so I guess I'll be okay. I love you. Just like those two weirdo snakes I mentioned. 1 + 1 = 0. Eternally horny, sorcerer. John Wade, letter, January 13th, 1968. The point of greatest danger for an individual confronted with a crisis is not during the period of preparation for the battle, nor fighting the battle itself, but in the period immediately after the battle is over. Then, completely exhausted and drained emotionally, he must watch his decisions most carefully. There is an increased possibility of error because he may lack the necessary cushion of emotional and mental reserve, which is essential for good judgment. Richard M. Nixon. After his 1941 defeat, Johnson's frustration and rage erupted over hapless aides. He was screaming and hollering and throwing his arms. Robert A. Cairo, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. We knew it was coming, sure, but I guess John hoped he had one more miracle up his sleeve. Didn't pan out. That last night when the returns started coming in, he had this blank expression on his face. I can't pin it down exactly. Just empty. Like a walking dead man. Defeat does things to people. Anthony L. Tony Carbo. He drank some, that's true. Clobbered like that, who wouldn't? Ruth Rasmussen. A candidate who has lost an election for the presidency, after all he has gone through in the campaign, is literally in a state of shock for at least a month after the election. Thomas E. Dewey. John called me that night. He sounded almost asleep. I guess the emotion came later. A delayed shock or something. He was always the type to stew, just like his father. Eleanor K. Wade. The cruel circumstances attending Al Smith's defeat caused the memory of it to rankle in him for a long time. Like everyone else, he wanted to be loved. Matthew and Hannah Josephson, Al Smith, Hero of the Cities. Exhibit 9. Primary Election Results. Democratic Farmer Labor Party, State of Minnesota, September 9, 1986. Durkee, 73%. Wade, 21%. Other, 6%. Footnote. Aren't we all? John Wade, he's beyond knowing. He's an other. For all my years of struggle with this depressing record, for all the travel and interviews and musty libraries, the man's soul remains for me an absolute and impenetrable unknown. A name tag drifting willy-nilly on oceans of hapless fact. 12 notebooks worth, and more to come. What drives me on, I realize, is a craving to force entry into another heart, to trick the tumblers of natural law, to perform miracles of knowing. It's human nature. We are fascinated, all of us, by the implacable otherness of others. And we wish to penetrate by hypothesis, by daydream, by scientific investigation, those leaden walls that encase the human spirit, that define it and guard it and hold it forever inaccessible. "I love you," someone says. And instantly we begin to wonder, well, how much? And when the answer comes, "with my whole heart," we then wonder about the wholeness of a fickle heart. Our lovers, our husbands, our wives, our fathers, our gods, they are all beyond us. End of note. Chapter 13. The Nature of the Beast. The war was aimless. No targets, no visible enemy. There was nothing to shoot back at. Men were hurt, and then more men were hurt, and nothing was ever gained by it. The ambushes never worked. The patrols turned up nothing but women and kids and old men. "Like that bullshit kids game," Rusty Callie said one evening. "They hide, we seek. Except we're chasing a bunch of gookish fucking ghosts." In the dark, someone did witch imitations. Someone else laughed. For Sorcerer, who sat listening at his foxhole, the war had become a state of mind. Not bedlam exactly, but the din was nearby. "Eyeballs for eyeballs," Callie said. "One of your famous Bible regulations." All through February they worked an AO called Pinkville, a chain of dark, sullen hamlets tucked up against the South China Sea. The men hated the place and feared it. On their maps, the sector was shaded a bright, shimmering pink to signify a built-up area with many hamlets and paddy dikes and fields of rice. But for Charlie Company, there was nothing bright about Pinkville. It was spook country, the geography of evil, tunnels and bamboo thickets and mud huts and graves. On February 25th, 1968, they stumbled into a minefield near a village called Lac Son. "I'm killed," someone said, and he was. A steady gray rain was falling. Thunder advanced from the mountains to the west. After an hour, a pair of dust-off choppers settled in. The casualties were piled aboard, and the helicopters rose into the rain with 3 more dead, 12 more wounded. "Don't mean zip," Callie said. His face was childlike and flaccid. He turned to one of the medics. "What's up, Doc?" 3 weeks later, on March 14th, a booby-trapped 155 round blew Sergeant George Cox into several large, wet pieces. Dyson lost both legs. Hendrickson lost an arm and a leg. 2 or 3 men were crying. Others wanted to cry but couldn't remember how. In the late afternoon of March 15th, John Wade received a short letter from Kathy. It was composed on light blue stationery with a strip of embossed gold running along the top margin. Her handwriting was dark and confident. "What I hope," she wrote him, "is that someday you'll understand that I need things for myself. I need a productive future, a real life. When you get home, John, you'll have to treat me like the human being I am. I've grown up. I'm different now, and you are too, and we'll both have to make adjustments. We have to be looser with each other, not so wound up or something. You can't squeeze me so much. I need to feel like I'm not a puppet. Anyway, just so you know, I've been going out with a couple of guys. It's nothing serious. Repeat, nothing serious. I love you, and I think we can be wonderful together." Sorcerer wrote back that evening, "What do you get when you breed VC with rats?" He smiled to himself and jotted down the answer on a separate slip of paper. "Midget rats," he wrote. At 7:22 on the morning of March 16th, 1968, the lead elements of Charlie Company, boarded a flight of helicopters that climbed into the thin, rosy sunlight, gathered into assault formation, then banked south and skimmed low and fast over scarred, mangled, bombed-out countryside toward a